Welcome back to the Public Lands Podcast. Following up on Shelley Silbert's discussion of the Bureau of Land Management 2 weeks ago, and Jeff Titan discussing the public dynamics of sound, or what he calls the sound commons, this week we have the privilege of hearing from Rachel Presley as she discusses sound and soundscape issues during the movement against the Dakota Access Pipeline, an issue that is very directly related to public land, water, and air. In fact, this is a good time to acknowledge, again, that this podcast is produced on land that is located on traditional, ancestral, and contemporary lands of Indigenous people, specifically Dakota land ceded in the treaties of 1837 and 1851. However, in all such acknowledgments, it is important to note that the terms of those treaties have been repeatedly violated by the U.S. government, and these lands were originally ceded at gunpoint. Some might want to imagine that this is ancient history, but as the case that Rachel brings us today illustrates, at Standing Rock Reservation in North Dakota, these dynamics of land, culture, occupation, and stewardship are as relevant as ever. Before we get to our conversation today, allow me to introduce Dr. Presley. Rachel Presley is an assistant professor of rhetorical theory in the Department of Writing Studies and the Department of Communication Studies at the University of Minnesota. As a critical rhetorician with training in cultural studies and political philosophy, her primary research interests engage issues of social movement and resistance rhetorics, transnational citizenship, and belonging, as well as postcolonial, decolonial, and anti-colonial theory. Rachel views marginality as a fundamentally intersectional position, so her scholarship makes use of rhetorical criticism, historiography, and critical qualitative methods to assess its representations and resistances. Her educational background involves a BA in English at Washington Jefferson College in Washington, Pennsylvania, an MA in Communication and Rhetorical Studies at Syracuse University, and a PhD in Rhetoric and Public Culture at Ohio University in Athens, Ohio. Her specialties include rhetorical theory and criticism, critical/cultural studies, Indigenous studies, and sound studies. She teaches classes that include rhetorical theory for writing studies and intercultural communication. And her publications involve the one we're going to talk about today at length, and I'll introduce that in a second, but as well also Between a Rock and a Hard Place, Rhetorical Strategies for Environmental Protection and Tribal Resistance in the Dakota Access Pipeline Movement. And that's in Decolonizing Native American Rhetoric, Communicating Self-Determination, a book edited by Casey Kelly and Jason Black. And finally, one other publication to mention here, Pink, Brown, and Red All Over, Representation at the 2017 Women's March on Washington. And that's in the Journal of Cultural Studies. Just one more thing before we turn to the interview. Even more so than in my conversation with Jeff Titan last week, I briefly mentioned my own research as part of this exchange. It has not been part of my method over the past several years of this podcast to talk about my own research, but it seemed appropriate given the topic and the delightful fact that this is a transitional podcast as we move to associate producer Hadley Nellis's reports in coming weeks, and then on to student-produced reports. There could not possibly be a better interview than Rachel to lead us into that exciting new content to come. Good morning, Rachel, and thanks for joining us at the Public Lands Podcast.
Great. Thank you so much for having me, Mark.
Well, I wanted to talk to you today about the article you published in the journal Argumentation and Advocacy, Sonic Colonizations, Sound Coalitions, Analyzing the Aural Landscape of Standing Rock's No Dapple Movement. You and your co-author, Jason Crane, conducted research concerning the soundscape at Standing Rock as a large coalition led by Standing Rock Sioux opposed construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline. For those unfamiliar with that movement, the coalition opposed the pipeline because it would threaten the area's water source, the Missouri River, and more globally due to the fact that continued extraction and burning of fossil fuels fuels climate change. So before we get to matters of sound and soundscape more specifically, could you tell us a bit about what brought you to study this movement?
Yeah, absolutely. It started at a very young age. I've always been interested in issues of social justice, and especially radical transformation. And I think that that started because I went to a very small public school in a southern conservative town in North Carolina, whose history books referred to the Civil War as the War of Northern Aggression. I'm not sure if you have ever heard that phrase, but in history books, oftentimes in the South, the Civil War is rewritten as the War of Northern Aggression. And beyond that, never once did any of my history classes mention the Trail of Tears by name. So I vividly remember talking about those issues with my family, and especially the dangers of that revisionist type of history. And I think that those conversations really catalyzed the underlying framework for my studies when I went to college and pursued my graduate degree. I think it's exceptionally important that in the midst of political turmoil, that we are sort of recentering our attention towards marginalized and minoritized populations for their leadership and their insight. And this is especially true for Indigenous populations, because those histories and struggles and victories are very often overlooked and forgotten. So for the Standing Rock movement in particular, it became such a monumental success because it reframed Indigenous sovereignty in a really strategic way that reached across different populations by focusing on global climate change. So that type of, I guess we would call it rhetorical maneuvering, obviously has its pros and its cons, but it's important to take the time to reflect on the global reach of that movement, and I think one that is exceptionally successful and worthy of our worldwide attention.
Oh, that's fascinating. It really reminds me of a book written by Llewellyn, Lies My Teacher Told Me, where he takes the 10 most popularly required high school history books and talks about what are some of the major things left out, for example, and, you know, the war on Mexico taking over half of Mexico's land is essentially left off of U.S. history as it's trained to students. So it's great to hear that sort of the, you know, you're a case where the critical histories still get to somebody and becomes motivating in order to tell those stories.
Exactly. His book was what, in the early 90s, if I'm not mistaken. And, you know, these types of conversations are still, I mean, they're still happening. They're still vitally important. I'd be interested to know if someone did, you know, sort of a follow up in 2020, if, you know, we're still learning the same lies in our school curricula.
Speaking of things that are left out, sound, you argue in the article that there was a sonic culture class at Standing Rock. And I think you'll agree that sound has not been, you know, on the forefront of most academic research historically, even to the extent that we kind of colonize studies of sound with the term text, you know,
right.
Applying a sort of literacy to something that is a very different form of communication. So there's a sonic culture clash at Standing Rock, and many of the white protesters that traveled to Standing Rock did not respect the more prayerful sound principles of the Indigenous leaders and cultures at the center of that space and movement. And it brought a sort of a Burning Man festival vibe to the scene, as well as a more traditionally Western sound sensibility in regard to protests. It should be very loud and disruptive. And you and Jason did a wonderful job in that article of making that case. Now, having very reductively paraphrased your thesis here, could you tell the listeners more about what was happening at Standing Rock and how you interpreted the opposition soundscape?
Sure. Well, first, thank you for those very kind words. Sound studies is such a conundrum, like you've mentioned. It's often not at the forefront of rhetorical studies. And then even beyond that, it's not harmonious in the way that we understand sort of sound as a whole. So I guess the first thing to note about the article is the structure of the argument itself. So Jason and I start first by talking about the differences between Indigenous and non-Indigenous ways of sort of being and intervening in the world. And we bring in a lot of Native literature to talk about Indigenous ontology as being circular and collectivistic. So thinking about being one with the earth as opposed to a more Western positioning that exploits the earth for individual gain. So we forefront that literature and then adhere to that positioning in our article by talking about the Standing Rock movement as being sort of a sonic circle. So at the center of the circle, we have the sacred fire. This is where, you know, indigenous leaders are positioning their arguments. They're in charge of the messaging. They're in charge of the distribution. And that's really at the forefront, the center of the Standing Rock campaign. And then the next level, or the next circle, we have sort of the allied or the invited space where we see some productive cross-cultural coalition building. So similar to what you talk about in your book, with Dana Lyons being invited into that space to perform. But then in the next circle is where we start to see really these co-opted performances. So people that are not invited to partake in that messaging, that are using Standing Rock as sort of their own sounding stage to distribute, you know, singles for distribution and release, trying to get their name out there in the music world, and not paying attention to the activist messaging that's going on there. And then the final ring is sonic weaponry. So thinking about the use of noise and sound as a type of like physical violence on groups. And we see that happening within and beyond the camp. So Jason and I come up with this metaphor of what we call white noise, pun intended, which boils down to non-Indigenous groups polluting a sonic landscape with their voices because they're not listening to the atmospheric pulse of an Indigenous group. They're not adhering to Indigenous instruction and Indigenous leadership, sort of co-opting the movement. So all of that sort of leads us to say in the end that in order to have a truly cross-coalitional alliance, we need to shift towards a really radical intersectional model of accompliship. And we can talk sort of about the differences between what it means to be an ally and what it means to be an accomplice, but really it boils down to dominant people that are leading from behind and taking instruction from marginalized and minoritized groups. So that's really what the whole article boils down to.
That's fascinating. And you know, you argue for a semiotic approach there as far as thinking about sound. And even within the world of sound studies, I think that that's a novel or important approach as opposed to the purely material, which you contrast on one side, which as I read that, that called to mind for me sort of the physics acoustical approach. In my own world, that would be the more, you know, strictly bioacoustical approach of measurement, which is, you know, not enough. It's important, it's useful, but it's not enough. And on the other hand, the reductively affective impressionistic perspective, you know, perhaps the gestalt approach that this is how it makes people feel, that can lead to universalization. And I really like this semiotic idea. And I find that approach very appealing. And in the course that this podcast is increasingly connected to, which is called Environmental Communication, I filmed a video lecture on semiotic ecology that I think jibes with your argument pretty well. In this case, it's not a sonic signifier, more I use the Lawn and Robbins's ideas around that. But I think from the perspective of methodology and or representation, I'm really curious about that. How does your semiotically supplemented view, where you're really trying to integrate these different ways of looking at sound in an interpretive approach, as you mentioned it, how does that view of soundscape differ from other approaches in sound studies, perhaps as instantiated in your analysis of the Standing Rock soundscape?
Yeah, such a good question. When we were doing research, we found that sound studies as a field is ironically not very harmonious. So people are taking an either or approach to materiality, and I guess what we would broadly call affect theory. And we found a lot of appeal in thinking about semiotic as sort of a signification that sits in the middle between those two camps. So the interrelations between sound as what we dominantly think of as a text and its effects on the primary rhetor, secondary rhetor, and the audience and the broader context at large. So thinking about semiotics gives us a bit more of an interpretive footing to think through the stickiness that differentiates like a loud protest chant versus a meditative moment of silence. And then we were thinking, well, if you step back and really like wade through that argument, then what we're actually talking about is a type of ontological positioning, the nature of being. So Jason and I had a bit of this like aha moment when we realized that this was the missing puzzle piece in sound studies, that a lot of scholars are sort of tangentially touching on this notion of being, but it's not at the forefront of the conversation. So our hope was that bringing that into the mix allows us to more clearly see the different ways that we both listen and make noise in our surrounding landscapes, because there's so many competing knowledges about sound. A semiotic approach really gives us the upper hand to think about sound as a symbol, you know, for politics, for history, and in the case of Standing Rock, especially a symbol for culture.
Oh, that's wonderful. It calls to mind the work of Denise von Glahn, who writes about music and the skillful listener, and about, for example, women composers have often been overlooked as male composers compose the sublime, the Grand Canyon, etc., whereas composers like Libby Larson are looking closely. Really, I also think of this Christine Baumler and others in the Backyard Phonology project that is all about people telling their stories of sort of deep ecology and listening and deep listening, and Pauline Oliveros' idea. So it really sounds like you're getting at that idea. How do you get people to listen, but not really as a sort of a feed exercise, but rather almost how do you get them to think about that as a political exercise? Is that fair as I think about some of the work you're doing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that as comm scholars, you know, comm 101, Introduction to Communication Studies, you know, we often have that introductory exercise about active listening and thinking about the difference between what it means to hear someone and what it means to listen to someone. And I think that deep listening is really the political exercise that we need to be partaking in. And that's what's really going to galvanize these movements and put them in the forefront of a dominant consciousness.
Oh, that's really interesting. And this article is published in the journal Argument and Advocacy. And given your research and analysis of the situation at Standing Rock, how would you transform this advocacy into action or change? And as I ask that, I realize it's really almost an unfair question that's not asked of somebody that, say, studies Virgil or, for that matter, most research. But, you know, it's something that I think that those of us that do work that we're hoping has some application and can change things ask ourselves. So, in other words, if you're now going to publish in a more applied venue, which I believe you kind of are thinking about, what steps might you take to improve the sound practices of these, say, white protesters that think of themselves as allies and or coalition of partners in an indigenous-led movement like that which took place at Standing Rock?
It's tricky. I mean, the first step is we have to take these conversations beyond the ivory tower, right? I mean, argumentation and advocacy is a phenomenal outlet, but it can only reach so many people that have access to that journal. And, you know, arguments aside about, you know, knowledge should be free, we shouldn't be paying for, you know, publication rights. It means that we have to be boots on the ground distributing these messages. So I think the first step is what you've already mentioned, this concept of deep listening as a really introspective and personal and reflective political act. And if we continue on with sort of this sound metaphor, then I think we also have to prioritize amplifying a collective voice. But the problem with that is that oftentimes when we think about the collective, we tend to be appealing to, for lack of a better word, the lowest common denominator, or a narrative that's safe, that's non-offensive, that it appeals to the dominant population, and that oftentimes mean that we have sort of a watered-down version of social justice and one that's not prioritizing those marginalized folks who are at the very center of these issues that we're fighting for, which is why I'm so impressed by your Idle No More chapter in your book. It seems like Cecilia was sort of this perfect spokeswoman for the movement. And like you said, she was really able to communicate across those cultural boundaries. So I think there's a lot of lessons to be learned from that in terms of choosing that strategic spokesperson, you know, to really galvanize the movement. But then I think sort of this last comment is a bit of speculation. So I'd really be interested to hear your thoughts. It seems like sound studies are really central to environmental struggles. So we have, you know, this concept of eco-musicology as sort of one branch that can speak to this entwinement of music and culture and nature. And I wonder how we could take those tenets from environmentalism and sort of shift those ideologies to apply them to other social and political struggles and still generate that same type of mass appeal. You know, like we don't seem to have the same type of, you know, mass rallying behind like raising the minimum wage that we do behind climate change. And I just wonder how we can shift, you know, the tenets of sound studies into different political realms. I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
You know, I agree, but this might be one of those things where creatures of the moment, I think if you would have said that 10 years ago, it would have sounded absurd. You know, it would have been exactly the opposite. Or 20 years ago, when there was this sort of real powerful that Naomi Klein writes about in her book, No Logo, you can really capture that sense. I remember assigning that book back then, and it really seemed in the late 90s, this moment of incredible possibility around questions that were not very environmentally inflected at all. In fact, that was the problem. You know, that was one of the problems. It didn't get at deeper some of the material questions. It was more at just sort of equity in a more limited sense that would be minimum wage, et cetera. And then 9/11 comes along, and I think if we see Naomi Klein's own trajectory, it kind of marks this, the shock doctrine idea that you know, catastrophes are like that are used in order to subvert movements and towards change and to get things going another direction. And that worked. And so, you know, once again, Naomi Klein, when you get to this changes everything with her moving to climate change, what it's basically shock doctrine is her argument at the beginning that now that's happening with geoengineering arguments, et cetera, that it'll just be taken advantage of to do more inequitable work. And so I don't know about sound studies. Yes, sound studies very much, I think. I don't know about sound studies. I do know in my own work, I've tended to focus on questions of environmental justice and environment rather than other sort of protest soundscapes. But I think it does, I think a semiotic approach like you're suggesting is one of the ways to go, because it's not something that gets stuck completely on what you might call the ethnographic particulars of the situation. You can kind of look at any situation, listen to it critically, and try to understand it in its particulars. So I agree. But then that you also mentioned, you know, one of the things I think is what used to be called, and it has to put a big SIC on this, straw man argument. So let's call it straw person arguments. Creating these binaries that because we're working in the areas of things like argumentation, we need to create these simplistic binaries that in the guise of being progressive are actually inversions of the hegemonic dominant view when we think we're doing great work. And how do we get to those complexities without erasing power? Nancy Shepherd Hughes is one of my mentors, and she talked about over and over again how sometimes, and I think this is partly our Puritan, I shouldn't say our, because it's not even really mine, but the sort of puritanical Protestant ethic of the United States, where look, seeking purity, and that purity hates contradiction. And the political is always in the contradictory, the critical story of the coyote trickster, et cetera, that you're never going to get these sort of purities of who's good, who's bad. But in fact, it's that if we look critically at power, it's going to be more complex than that. And I think sound can do that sometimes, because it kind of forces us to say, who's being heard? you know, and who's not being heard. And that's what I was trying to get at, that chapter you're talking about. And I think that's what you're getting at in this wonderful Standing Rock, like literally what's being heard there and how. And I think that's one of the powers of the work that you're doing. And I hope you do apply it to a lot of different protest contexts.
Definitely. I mean, it's funny that you mentioned the straw person argument, because Jason and I had, you know, a real troubling moment of reflection when we were working through, you know, foregrounding the context for this issue and talking about the differences between, you know, indigenous and non-indigenous ontologies, because we were worried that perhaps describing those differences could end up portraying groups as flat and monolithic, which may even contribute to sort of a straw man argument in and of itself, and merely trying to provide the right type of context that we're brushing over the intricacies of each group that lend themselves to that that argument later on down the line. But I think that type of ontological positioning is necessary in order for us to sort of wade through that stickiness later on, in terms of figuring out whose voice is being heard, who's being positioned at, you know, the forefront, and who's strategically maneuvering those messages.
Oh, that's a really good point. You make me think of, for example, Kresh's book on the ecological Indian, and about how that's been used against Native Americans so often as a sort of romantic idea of the noble savage that was a colonial, you know, trope. And I think that we see that repeated as well. And in addition to the adventurers that you mentioned, they're coming to Standing Rock looking for their own salvation, kind of in that, you know, ecological Indian, if you will. This moment that was sort of one of those aha moments for me, I was sitting in a context in Asheville, North Carolina, and we were watching Musicwood, the documentary about the clear-cutting the Songhees rainforest, which is an extremely complex situation, and that's one of the beauties of this documentary. And two of the activists that they foreground are these indigenous activists that are against the clear-cutting, and then they also, the people that are part of the group that is very much pushing the clear-cutting is part of the tribal council. And that wasn't surprising to me at all. Anybody that spends a lot of time in politics knows that people are complicated and that these things are never sort of simple binaries. And afterwards, though, the aha moment was a lot of my colleagues that I were at the Q&A were essentially critiquing the filmmaker for not presenting indigenous perspectives. And it struck me what they meant was that those tribal council perspectives were not indigenous. It was one of those things that, you know, tautologies of creating these categories.
Oh, absolutely. Well, first off, I really like that you brought up Shepherd Crutch's book, the Ecological Indian, because as you were sort of talking through your colleagues that were sort of upset with the filmmaker, that falls right into his categorization of thinking about indigenous folks as being sort of anachronistic, you know, as being wholly one with the earth. And then anything that is slightly deviates from that type of trope is one that we become uncomfortable with because it's unfamiliar, you know, and it doesn't fall into our standard the dominant standard categorization of indigenous peoples. So I think you're spot on with that. But then to circle back to your question, I think you're right. Like sound is the missing puzzle piece in these larger conversations about social justice and activism. I'm working on a book project now that looks at Standing Rock as one chapter, but then I have three other indigenous land rights movements that are focused on the soundscape at hand and the way in which environment is being portrayed in sort of a different ideological fashion. So for example, the Aboriginal Australian Stolen Generation movement is an environmental movement, but it's one in which environment is positioned as family. We have the terra nullius, the land belongs to no one argument, in which we're able to make that comparison. And that happens through, you know, a competing soundscape that we're not used to hearing. So I think sound is the way to really enter into the conversation.
Well, that's great. I can't wait to read your book. Do you have a working title yet?
I do. Well, it's still working, but so far we have digital diasporas as sort of the main headline, because the latter part of the book thinks about place making in both physical and the digital sense. So the way that Indigenous groups are reclaiming place and space on an online platform as sort of like a symbolic reclamation of land.
Oh, that's great. I don't want to keep you any further, and I would say that this has been, for me, a really wonderful session, because this podcast has tended to be interviews with stewards talking about the great things they're doing in various public lands, waters, etc., and as advocates, and it's been nice to sort of talk about some of the theoretical issues that sometimes we can forget as we're doing that. Kind of on the ground applied work. So I really appreciate talking to you, and thanks so much for taking your time out of a very busy start of the semester to talk with us about your research.
Oh, likewise. I'm so appreciative of you asking me to be a part of the podcast. It was a real joy to talk with you today, and I am really excited to hear more from your class this semester and the important conversations that they're going to be taking part in.
All right. Thanks, Rachel. Take care.
Awesome. Thank you. You too.